Okay, and we're starting. So welcome everybody, it's wonderful to see you all. This is the first week in our series in preparation for Shavuos on Rambam's introduction to his commentary on Mishnah, Maimonides' introduction to his commentary on the oral law. And the plan is, as I said, to do about a six-week course, a six-week class. Each week we're gonna cover a different topic that the Rambam wrote about. Probably one of the nicest things about his commentary is that it's varied. It covers a wide variety of issues, as well as its structure is that it's modular. Every probably two pages or so is its own self-contained topic. So it really lends itself to a multi-week class series. So looking forward to that. Just first, a bit of housekeeping. This is a new time that I'm giving this year. In the winter, we did it Motzei Shabbos after Shabbos, but now with the clock change, it's a little bit later. So we're experimenting doing it on Sunday nights at 8:30. I'd love to hear feedback from you if the time works or doesn't work, or if there's an alternative day or an alternative time that would work for most people. That's definitely an option to modify things. Second of all, unlike in past classes where there was usually a source sheet that I would distribute, because we're going to be learning a text, what I'm going to do is to share the screen of Rambam's commentary to Mishnah, his introduction to Mishnah, which Sefaria has both in English and in Hebrew. So we're going to use that after this week. If you have your own, you're also welcome to follow along in your own if you have one at home. But that's what we're going to be doing. And if there's any supplementary material, I'll definitely send that out. Before we start, I just want to speak for just a minute or two about the tragedy at Meron. It's just a terrible, terrible tragedy that affected the entire Jewish world, the entire Jewish people. My family's shul in Bergenfield, one of the children who was killed, davened in our shul. So the Beth Abraham and Tina community is hurting as well. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to dedicate the Limud HaTorah, the learning of Torah and the learning of Mishnah in the memory of all of the victims that were killed in this Lag BaOmer tragedy. I believe it's the Arizal, it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch. The Arizal, one of the Kabbalists in the 16th century, he notes that the word Mishnah in Hebrew, Mem Shin Nun Hey, if you rearrange the letters, becomes the word Nishama, soul. And so the Arizal says that the learning of Mishnayos, or learning about Mishnah, is something that is particularly auspicious to learn in someone's memory to elevate their soul. Obviously, the Arizal was a Kabbalist and had many mystical ideas, but if I can try to explain it perhaps on a more rational or a more simple level for myself and others that aren't so well-versed in Lurianic Kabbalah to appreciate, I'll just give you an example that if you've ever been asked to speak either at a happy occasion or at a sad occasion about a person, whether it be a simcha like a bar mitzvah or a bas mitzvah or a wedding or some happy occasion, or God forbid, a sad occasion like a funeral, the speech that you give about a person, you always have this challenge where you're trying to essentially encapsulate a person's essence in however short of a time frame you have, whether it's 2 minutes or 20 minutes or even an hour. It's a Herculean task. It's almost impossible to do. If you give just examples, essentially a laundry list of what a person did in their life or what they've done up until a point in their life, it's really not going to be sufficient. However much you say, you're going to inevitably be forced to leave stuff out. You will trivialize the activities that you didn't mention. And you're essentially giving a very limited perspective of what they did. On the other hand, if you just go for the super abstract, the philosophy, the Weltanschauung, that the person had, it will be aloof or cold, detached, vague, unrelatable, or unappreciated by the average person that didn't know the person so intimately well. And so what most people do, whether it be a happy occasion or a sad occasion, is that they'll choose certain examples and weave them together by showing that these examples are paradigms for broader personality traits and values and characteristics that the person has. At least that's that's what they teach you in rabbinic speaking class when I was in Smicha. But that's what most people do. You take certain ideas, you pick certain vignettes or stories about the person that illustrate their values, that illustrate their qualities, and you weave it together by showing what they represent or what that person stood for. And in that way, you're not trivializing the stuff that you don't mention, but it's still personable, relatable, and concrete so that people can appreciate it even if they're not intimately versed with this person in their life. And that's, in a certain sense, what Mishnah is. Over the next few weeks, we'll learn about how the Rambam conceptualized Mishnah and its place in both the written and oral traditions. But Mishnah is sort of a bridge between the written law and the Talmud and the Gemara. The Torah is, if you will, a very abstract book. The Rambam will provide examples of this in his introduction. But the psukim in the Torah, the verses in the Torah that talk about Jewish law, are almost impossible to read without a tradition. They're very, very vague, and perhaps intentionally so, because they illustrate really very, very broad philosophical strokes of what God was trying to convey. The opposite end of the spectrum is the Gemara. The Gemara deals with all the super nitty-gritty details, the derivations, the back-and-forth discussions, every single scenario possible that people could think of. The Mishnah is somewhat in between. The Mishnah is a code of law. It lists concrete examples, not anything vague like in the Torah. But at the same time, it doesn't cover every single example that's written. Rather, it's almost a conceptual framework of all the ideas that are encompassed in halacha, but they're rooted in concrete cases, in legal paradigms of relatable cases that even a young child that's learning Mishnah can appreciate. And perhaps that's what the Arizal means when he says that learning Mishnah is connecting to the Jewish soul. Because when we try to encapsulate what the essence of a person is, we don't go for the abstract philosophy, or on the flip side, we don't go for just the actions that they do. We use the concrete actions and the philosophy, and we try to synthesize that to pick certain vignettes in their life to isolate and express the values, the broad values that they stood for. That's what we do when we speak at a simcha or conversely at a sad occasion. We try to encapsulate what the person stood for. And so the learning of the Rambam's commentary to Mishnah should also touch the neshamos, touch the souls of those whose lives were tragically cut short, and it should elevate them. And at the same time, based on what I just said, the saliency and the potency of learning Mishnah is not relegated to those that are no longer on this world. There are neshamos in living, breathing bodies all around us. And when we learn Mishnah, or we learn the commentary to the Mishnah, or the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah, we can tap into that soul as well, even for those that are still alive. And with that in mind as well, I would like to dedicate the class and the learning as a merit for Refuah Shleima to all the Jews, and in particular to those in our community that are not yet well, in particular Lloyd Epstein. The Mishnah project that the community will be undertaking on Shavuos is a merit for his recovery, and it is my hope that the learning that we do over these weeks should also be as a merit to his recovery, as well as in addition to everyone else that needs a Refuah Shleima. Okay. With that in mind, let's begin. So the Rambam wrote this commentary to Mishnah at a very young age. He started writing this commentary at the age of 23, and he finished writing it at the age of 33. It took him 10 years, long time to complete this undertaking. As we'll see, that time period in his life was extremely, extremely tense. He basically could have been killed at any point during those 10 years. We'll explore a little bit more about his history. The goal of this week's class is to try to put the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah and his commentary on Mishnah in its historical context in the Rambam's life, both his personal, professional, and literary careers. Those are three different elements of the Rambam: his personal history, his professional history, and his literary history, what he wrote. Those are three different threads in his life, and the commentary to Mishnah really intersected all three of them. And to kind of understand what the point or what his goal was when writing this commentary to Mishnah, and especially his introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah, the only way in my mind to really appreciate it or to fully appreciate it is to put it in its historical context in the Rambam's personal life, his professional life, and his literary life. So with that in mind, let's begin. I'm going to share the screen with the sources that I prepared. It's a bit of a PowerPoint presentation, if you will. Let me see if I can pull it up. Here we go. So the title is No Time to Lose. I'll explain where I got that quote from in a moment. So this is a picture of the Rambam. If any of you noticed on the flyer that was sent out by Lincoln Square, the picture on that poster was a colorized version of this, but it's also photoshopped. And if you'll notice, the Rambam doesn't seem to have pace. And in the colorized version, they added sideburns to him. The Rambam had an interesting opinion about payas, about sideburns. His opinion was that you had to grow them, but you had to grow sideburns, but they could be extremely, extremely short, much shorter than what most Jews nowadays hold. Just a bit of an interesting fun fact about how Jewish revisionist history has continued to this very day. But anyway, but the quote from the Rambam, or the quote that I chose as the title, No Time to Lose, it actually comes from a video. If you're interested in spending an hour learning about the Rambam, I would highly recommend the video. The link is on this sheet below. It was produced by Rabbi and historian Rabbi Beryl Wein. It's about an hour long, and his organization uploaded it to YouTube. You can watch it for free. Let me see if I can just show it to you if you give me a second. Here, we share screen. Here we go. So the top one, Rambam, the Story of Maimonides. It's about an hour. It's about an hour long. It was produced by Rabbi Beryl Wein. Leonard Nimoy voices Rambam. So if you ever want to hear Jewish philosophy and Psukim and Mishnayos recited by Spock, it's a great place to look. It's very interesting. It's geared for children, and so it's a little bit over dramatized, but I found it very interesting, and it's enjoyable to watch. Anyway, so in that movie, Leonard Nimoy, or as Rambam, said the phrase "no time to lose" many times when Rambam was about to embark on a new project. And if you study Rambam's history, that phrase "no time to lose," the Rambam constantly being buffeted by public service imperatives or jobs that he felt obligated to take upon himself or were foisted on him by force, that really articulates his literary career and his professional career. So with that in mind, let's look at a brief history of the Rambam's life. This is a timeline of various milestones in his life. The Rambam was born, there are varying accounts, but what most scholars believe, he was born in the year 1138 and he died in the year 1204. According to legend, he was born on the 14th of Nisan, on Erev Pesach. He was born in Cordova, which is in Spain. Then it was what was called Al-Andalus, the Iberian Peninsula, which was under Islamic rule. It was towards the end of the Golden Age of it was in the middle of the Golden Age of Spain, where Jews lived within relative security and freedom. He lived there for about 10 years. The Almohads, which was a fanatical Berber Muslim group, came and took over Cordova and most of the Iberian Peninsula and forced the Maimon family into hiding, and they ran basically wandering throughout the Iberian Peninsula. They wandered into the northern part of the peninsula, which was being controlled by Christians, but they were forced out due to persecution. Eventually, they settled in Morocco after about 10 years. And it's during those years of wandering that the Rambam begins writing his Mishnah. He wrote his commentary to Mishnah. And this introduction was the first project that he undertook. He ended up editing it multiple times throughout those 10 years, but it was the first thing that he ever undertook to write. In that time, he was actually interrupted by a public need, which we'll see later on in detail what it was, but it was when he wrote his famous Igeret Hashmad, his epistle or his letter on martyrdom. In the year 1164, he went to Israel, but was forced to, again, due to persecution and death threats, to go to Egypt, to Alexandria, where he lived for the rest of his life. His father, Rabbi Maimon, died in 1166. 2 years later, he finished his commentary to the Mishnah. He then wanted to start a new project, which was to write the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot, as well as the Mishnah Torah, which was the code of Jewish law that studied in yeshivas around the world. But before that, he needed to write a letter to the Jews in Yemen. That should say Igeret Tema, not Tema, I'm sorry. It was the epistle to Yemen, which was became extremely famous in talking about Mashiach and living as Jews and under difficult conditions and what will happen when Mashiach comes and stuff like that. Various different elements of Jewish theology and halacha. Once he wrote that, he began his large project of the Sefer HaMitzvot and the Mishnah Torah. But 1 year later, his brother, his only brother, David, died. At that point, the Rambam needed to support not only his family, but also his brother's family. That was when he started charging money for being a doctor. The Rambam settled in Fustat, which was a suburb of Cairo at the time. And shortly thereafter, the Rambam became the chief rabbi of Cairo, or in what was called the Nagid, the political ruler of the city, which, as we'll go into a little bit more detail later on, was actually very significant for the Jews there. At the time, it was being controlled by the Karaites. And so the Rambam, who was not a Karaite, obtaining the political position of being the leader of the community, was a very significant thing. At that time, he also became the personal physician to the Sultan of Egypt in Cairo. And in the year 1180, also about 10 years after he started writing, he finishes Mishnah Torah. 6 years later, his only surviving child, Rabbi Avraham, was born. And then 4 years later, he finishes his famous philosophical work, the Mora Nevuchim. And then 14 years later, he died at the age of 66. He died on the 20th of Teves, and according to Jewish lore, he is buried in Tiberia in Tiberius. You can go to his grave even today. So what I did on this timeline was I chose various professional and personal milestones in his life, and his literary activities I put in colored boxes. And if you'll notice, he has these long projects. We don't know when he started writing Mora Nevuchim, but it may have even been before he wrote Mishnah, his commentary to Mishnah, even before he was, even probably even 5 years before that. So he had many long, extensive literary projects that were constantly being interrupted by either smaller projects, but mostly public service activities that he needed to do, whether it's writing letters on Jewish law, on Jewish public policy to foreign countries, or becoming the leader of a Jewish community, or suffering personal tragedies, being on the run, having family members die. And the Rambam always put the needs of the community and what he believed was a public need before his own literary aspirations. And that really was the motivation for writing the commentary to the Mishnah, as we'll see. So let's go into detail a little bit more about the Rambam's life. So as I mentioned earlier, the Rambam was born 1138. According to some, it was 1135. He was the seventh generation of Dayanim in the Iberian Peninsula. Here's a picture of the Iberian Peninsula. He was born in Cordova, which is, I guess, the bottom third of the Iberian Peninsula in the center. The northern part is Christian Spain. I don't remember the exact dates, but in the, I think it was 797, when the Islamic conquest went into Spain and went all the way, they advanced almost into France, and then they were pushed back by the Christians, and then but they ensued several centuries of the Christians trying to reconquer the entire Iberian Peninsula, which happened during the days of the Spanish Inquisition. And that was when the Jews were kicked out of Spain. But until that time, the Jews lived in with relative peace in what was called Al-Andalus, the Iberian Peninsula. He was the seventh generation of Dayanim that lived there. The Jewish community in Spain is exceedingly old. The Rambam traced his lineage to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, to the writer of the Mishnah, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was a descendant of David HaMelech, so the Rambam traced his lineage to the Davidic dynasty. The Rambam had one older brother named David. The Rambam's mother died in childbirth, so you have to picture a single father raising two children. In relative peace, his father was a Dayan in the community. His father was a student of the Rimigash, who the Rambam held in the greatest esteem, and the Rimigash was the one of the greatest students of Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, who was the first one to really write a halachic work on the Talmud. And Rav Yitzchak Alfasi was the one of the students of Rabbeinu Hananel from Tunisia, Karawan, who was essentially a disciple of the Gaonim. So if you keep on working your way up the tradition, the Rambam had a direct link through his father to the Gaonim, the post-Talmudic scholars in Bavel, in Babylon, in Iraq, that were essentially the torchbearers of the Talmudic tradition. The Rambam's primary teacher was his father. In addition to learning Chumash, Tanakh, Mishnah, Gemara, the Rambam also became very well versed in philosophy, as well as in mathematics, science, medicine, etc. They lived there till the Rambam was 10 years old, at which point the Berbers, the fanatical Muslims known as the Almohads, they conquered southern Spain, and including Cordova. They gave the Jews the choice to either convert to Islam or to leave. And the Rambam's father, Rabbi Maimon, he chose exile. And so at first they wandered north into Christian Spain, but they were even they were persecuted even more than they were in Spain, in Muslim Spain. So they turned back south and wandered for about 10 years in Spain, southern Spain and North Africa, until they reached Fez in Morocco. So just parenthetically, the Rambam's extremely negative and persecuted brief time period in Christian Spain was the only time that he was exposed to Christianity. The only time he came face to face with Christians, pretty much in his entire life in any extensive fashion. So some historians posit that the Rambam's extremely negative characterization of Christianity as idolatry came from that experience. Again, I'm not an expert in Rambam and Jewish history or Jewish philosophy in that regard, but that's what I've heard. And at that point, the Rambam settled in Fez. Now, even in Fez, life was not really easy for the Rambam. You had this weird scenario, almost like Soviet Russia towards the end of the Soviet Union, where on the outside you had to appear non-Jewish. In Fez, it was being walking around pretending to be a Muslim. But all the authorities knew who the great rabbis, who the great scholars were. And as long as your Judaism was hidden and you paid off the right people, the rabbis could still be rabbis and practice Judaism. They just had to do it in hiding. So you had these secret yeshivos, secret shuls that operated, and sometimes they would be raided, sometimes they wouldn't. You had to pay off the right people. And it didn't work for everybody. You had to essentially be a noted person in the community in order for them to give you a free pass. So Rabbi Maimon and his children, David and the Rambam, they were some of those people. So walking outside in the market, they dressed as Muslims. But when they went into their houses, they had a secret yeshiva in the basement. I'm They didn't personally, but the Rev of the community had a secret yeshiva in his basement. During that time of wandering and clandestine Judaism, the Rambam wrote a number of things. We don't have many of these. The Rambam says that he wrote a commentary to the Gemara on, I would say, close to two-thirds of the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, as well as some of the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. We don't really have almost any of it. It was lost. And the Rambam talks about it in his commentary to Mishnah, saying that he'd already done this. So when the Rambam was basically in his teens, he was writing a commentary to the Talmud, and it got lost. There are different theories as to why it got lost, some historical, some practical. We don't know why. But he stopped doing that. In his comment, in his introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah at the very end, we'll see it at the very end of the class, he says that he's putting that on hold, basically, to write this introduction to Mishnah, because he feels that it's more important for, I'm paraphrasing and embellishing, it will be more important for the average citizen to read this commentary to Mishnah than it would to read this commentary to the Talmud and to complete it. In addition to writing this commentary to Mishnah, he also wrote what I said was the Igeret Hashmad, which was talking about how Jews should not give up their lives if they, rather than be forced to convert to Islam, like the Rambam was doing, pretend to be a Muslim on the outside, but on the inside remain Jewish and perform Judaism secretly. And he talks about all the various rules about when one needs to give up their lives or not. And the Rambam was writing this at a very young age in response to a venerable sage at the time who publicized that Jews needed to give up their lives rather than be forcibly converted to Islam. And so the Rambam was taking on, I'm not sure who it was, but taking on somebody ostensibly with a lot of clout and communal influence, who was apparently a Torah scholar of note. And the Rambam criticized him and was not embarrassed because he felt that there was a public need to do that. Another book that he, or another writing project that he began undertaking, was a book of prophecy. He mentions this in his introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah, that he wants to write a book about prophecy, and he started writing it. He started writing a book about what nevuah, what prophecy is, how it works, what's its purpose. We don't have that, and there's a reason why. In his introduction to the Mora Nevuchim, one of his last works, he says that initially I was going to write this, but I realized that it would be better to sort of combine it and have it absorbed into the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, which is a broader, more expansive philosophical treatise. And prophecy will occupy a small portion of that. So once again, you have the Rambam embarking on this very ambitious writing project, having it being put on hold almost indefinitely, and then ultimately scrapping it and reworking it for something that he felt would serve the public better. In addition to all of this religious Jewish works, he also wrote a number of medical works throughout his life. We still have them, and they're studied by medical historians to this very day. Once again, you have an example of a writing which the Rambam felt would serve a public good. The Rambam, in addition to being a rabbi, was the doctor in his community, and he felt that this was necessary. So right now we've covered about, I would say, the first quarter, third of the Rambam's life, which was basically being in exile and could have been killed at any point in time. During that time period, in addition to all of his writing and public service, the Rambam married. I believe he had a daughter. And they went to Israel, but they weren't able to last there very long. It's a little unclear why they were forced to leave. Some say that they had no source of livelihood. They were starving. Another says that they realized there was a price on their heads, that they were going to be killed. For whatever reason it was, life in Israel at the time was untenable. So they moved to Egypt. They settled in Alexandria at first. Rabbi Maimon, the Rambam's father, died at the time in 1166. The Rambam subsequently moved to Fustat, which was, as I said earlier, a suburb of Cairo. At that time, I don't know the exact analog of what I would compare it to nowadays, and I don't want to even try because I might insult the community. It was, in terms of, I guess, Jewish, not infrastructure, but Jewish educational-wise, it was a bit of a backwater community compared to other areas in the Jewish world at the time, say like Provence or French Judaism at the time, or even Yemen for that matter. There were some Jewish scholars there. The Rambam was pretty much the only game in town at the time, and most of the people were quite ignorant there. They knew the basics, but nothing beyond that. According to the Rambam, many people didn't even know how many mitzvot there were. Additionally, at the time, the quote-unquote rabbis and the political elite of the Jewish community in Fustat and in Egypt in general were Karaites. The Karaites were a sect in Judaism. They exist to this day in some form or another, that only accepted the veracity and the authenticity of the written law, the Torah Shebichsav, the Tanakh, the 24 books in the Torah. Anything post that, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Talmud, the Midrash, all of those things they believed were human invention and had no impact and no role in Judaism. Now, the mainstream Jewish community, and especially nowadays, we don't accept that, but back then, there was a tug of war. There was a tug of war, and oftentimes the wealthy political elite were these Karaite rabbis. Unfortunately, one of the views of the Karaite rabbis were that you should not go to doctors. You should not seek out medical aid. You should pray to God, and that should be it. So personal hygiene and healthcare in Fustat was not the greatest. It left much to be desired. Unfortunately, there was a plague, and the Rambam lost his wife and daughter in the plague because of that. A few years later, the Rambam's brother, David, who basically made a deal with his brother in the Torah, Yitzchak's children, Yaakov's children, of the 12 tribes, we have Yisachar and Zvulun. So Yisachar undertook to dedicate his life to learning, and Zvulun went out and supported his brother, and they split the funds, and they also split the spiritual rewards. They entered into a Torah partnership. So the Rambam and his brother David did the same thing. According to the Rambam, David was a Torah scholar in his own right. Rambam seems to have been the greater of the two, and they worked out a deal that David would become a merchant, that David would support the Rambam. The Rambam did not want to charge money for his medical services. And so David undertook to support both families, and the Rambam would dedicate his time to learning and to public service, and they would split the both physical and spiritual rewards of their combined joint enterprise. Unfortunately, David died at sea on a business trip. And now the Rambam, who had remarried in the interim, I don't think he had a child yet, but the Rambam needed to support himself, his wife, and in addition to that, support David, David's widow, as well as David's children. And that's sort of the, I guess, logistical and financial burden that the Rambam had. But if you consider the psychological and the psychological burden that the Rambam never had a mother. The Rambam's unit, his very intimate family unit, that was basically his only community that he had, even in Fustat, he was isolated because he was just so different than everyone else. His family unit was his father, his brother, and their wives. Now, the Rambam had already lost his first wife and daughter, and now he lost his closest friend since he was an infant. He lost his older brother, David. He was extremely depressed, and it was with the encouragement of his second wife that he reemerged into the public role. He started charging money for his medical services to support both his family as well as his brother's family, and that was in addition to all of the learning and teaching and writing that he did. Now, at that time, there were also positive things. There were also opportunities that emerged in Fustat. As I mentioned earlier, he was appointed the Nagid, the leader of the Jewish community, which significantly weakened the influence of the wealthy Karaite leaders. The Jewish community became much more educated under the Rambam. And in addition to that, he became the personal physician to the Sultan, which also gave him considerable sway and influence to help and benefit the Jewish community throughout the entire caliphate. At that time, he also wrote Igeret Teiman to strengthen the Yemenite Jewish community. As I said earlier, he remarried to a woman, I believe her name was Jamila. He had a son, Avraham, who succeeded his father when the Rambam passed away. And at that time, he wrote a multitude of both halachic, philosophical, and secular works. He completed his commentary to the Mishnah. He wrote the Sefer HaMitzvos and the Mishnah Torah, the most comprehensive code of Jewish law that we ever had. He wrote the Mora Nevuchim, which was the Guide to the Perplexed, one of the most famous and widely studied Jewish philosophy works. As I mentioned earlier, he also wrote several medical works. And in addition to all of that, he wrote various letters, questions, answers to other Jewish leaders, to individuals. And we have many of them that have been published. And they're on almost every topic imaginable. It ranges from grammar, science, philosophy, law, Jewish public policy, everything. So now that we have this sort of broad picture of who the Rambam was, what he wrote, what he did, let's zero in and talk about the Mishnah, talk about the commentary to the Mishnah. As I said, he wrote it at a very young age, over a time period of about 10 years. What's noticeable is that if you compare the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah, which, and the introduction in particular, which encompasses both legal and philosophical elements, and you compare it to his later legal and philosophical writings, such as the Mishnah Torah, the Code to Jewish Law, and on the philosophical end, the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, you'll see that while the Rambam changed his view on Jewish law, there are many, many instances throughout his commentary to the Mishnah, which the Rambam changes when he writes his Code of Jewish Law towards the end of his life. When it comes to the philosophical stuff, there are almost no differences. You could probably count on one hand how many times the Rambam seems to disagree with what he wrote when he was younger to what he wrote at the end of his life, the Mora Nevuchim. It seems that from a very early age, in his teens, the Rambam, with the aid of his father and studying both secular and Jewish works, had perfected and completed his own Weltanschauung, a philosophy about Judaism, about Jewish law, and the evolution of Jewish law, and just various areas of Jewish thought that remained virtually unchanged his entire life. Just something very interesting to note and to keep in mind when we learn about the Rambam and the Rambam's positions on things in his introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah, that most of these things, even though he wrote it in his teens and 20s, he agreed with it to the very end of his life. Just something to keep in mind. Now, the Rambam, at the end of the introduction, which we'll hopefully see in the last class, he discusses the purposes for why he's writing this commentary, why he's writing this commentary to Mishnah. And he gives four reasons. The first is a commentary. We have to keep in mind that at the time, there was no Rashi. Rashi is the primary commentary that everybody uses when they study the Talmud. There was no Rashi because Rashi lived around the same time as the Rambam, but they lived in very different parts of the world. The Rambam did not have access to Rashi and vice versa. So if you're learning a Gemara in Spain, North Africa, or the Middle East, you really don't have any commentary to the Talmud. You had a little bit of Rabbeinu Hananel, you had a halachic synopsis by the Rif, but that's it. You did not have a commentary to understanding Mishnah. So the Rambam took it upon himself. He felt that this would open up rabbinic literature to people. The second purpose of the Rambam was to show the conclusions. If somebody learns Mishnah and Gemara, they'll notice that it's very difficult many times to figure out what the Gemara's conclusion is about a certain law. And so what the Rambam did is that at the end of every Mishnah or almost every Mishnah, he writes what the psak halacha, what the consensus is. The third purpose that the Rambam had in mind when he wrote this commentary was that it was to serve as an introduction to Talmud study. What the Rambam envisioned was that somebody who was just beginning to learn rabbinic literature, they would read his introduction and they would read his commentary to Mishnah, And that would serve as the gateway to enable them to learn Gemara. And so the Rambam saw his writing as a public service, not to the rabbinic elite per se, but to the laymen, those that did not really study Talmud yet on their own or lacked the ability to study Talmud on their own, which was most of the population. And then the final part, which the Rambam envisioned both for the novice as well as the experienced Torah scholar, was that it would serve as a reference guide, as a review for people to remind themselves what the Mishnayos mean, what the Halacha is. Those are the four purposes that the Rambam had in mind when he wrote his commentary. Now, if we keep in mind, especially the third, but honestly, if we keep in mind all of these purposes, this was geared for somebody that was not really well-versed in rabbinic literature. To that end, the Rambam did not write this commentary in Hebrew. Most of the Rambam's works, with the exception of Mishneh Torah, the Code of Jewish Law, which was written for the scholars, all the rest of his works, which were meant to be approachable by the every person, were written in Arabic, the local language. So that may have worked in 12th or in 13th century Egypt. Nowadays, in America, that is a bit of a challenge. Most of us don't read Arabic. We don't understand Arabic. And this wasn't only a challenge in the year 2021. This was actually a challenge even during the Rambam's own lifetime, because there were many people in Provence, in France, that had heard about the greatness and the uniqueness of the Rambam and wanted to study his works, but they didn't read or speak Arabic. They spoke French. They read French. They read, may have read Latin. They read Hebrew. They certainly didn't read Arabic. And so let's envision a map of the Jewish world at the time of the Rambam, at the end of the beginning of the 1200s. So the Rambam lived in, he was born in Spain, in Cordova. You can see that on the map. Then he wandered around southern Spain. He went to North Africa. That's cut off on the bottom. He wandered all the way to the other side of the map, to Egypt, which is cut off. So now the Rambam is pretty much isolated from the rest of the mainstream or main areas of Jewish scholarship, which were in France and in Provence, which is southern France, on along the, southern part of France and northeastern part of Spain. So you have Montpellier, Marseille, those areas were near Monaco. That area of Provence was where a lot of Jewish scholarship took place. And if you think about it, it is sort of a bridge between Spanish or Sephardic Jewry and German and French Jewry. And so it really, the Provence scholars really served as the bridge between Ashkenazic and Sephardic scholarship and developed a unique approach and corpus of literature of their own. So these scholars in Provence really wanted to get a hold of the Rambam's writings. And they requested them, but they said, we don't speak Arabic. We don't understand Arabic. Can we have somebody translate it? So even during the Rambam's lifetime, people were hired to translate the Rambam's writings into Hebrew. So initially, the Rambam's commentary to Mishnah were published in basically like a serialized book. They were published in pamphlets, and only when it was completed did the Rambam publish a new edition, which was important because unfortunately, some communities only got the initial ones, and the Rambam may have changed his mind, and they didn't get that, which led to many questions, mistakes, and a lot of different manuscripts, which people nowadays, when scholars are studying it, trying to figure out what the Rambam actually meant, have to cross-reference, which makes it a bit difficult. But going back to then, you had communities and wealthy individuals that hired patrons, that served as patrons, hired Spanish and Arabic-speaking scholars to translate the Rambam's writings into Hebrew. So there are three primary ones during the Rambam's lifetime and immediately afterwards that are known. Perhaps the most well-known and the most accepted was Ibn Tibbon, who was a Yemenite scholar. The Rambam corresponded with him about different instructions of how to translate his own work. The current, or the, I guess, the most traditional version of the Rambam's commentary to Mishnah that we've had pretty much till the last century is a compilation of three different translators. Ibn Tibbon is one of them, but there are two others, and each contributed certain mesechtos that were then aggregated together to publish the Hebrew version of the Rambam's commentary to Mishnah, which we had until it was reworked by more critical scholars in the last century. So the person that wrote the part that we're going to study, the Rambam's introduction, his name was Rav Yehuda al-Charizi. He was born in Spain, and he was hired by the Jews of Montpellier, which is, if you can see, it's in the French Riviera area. It's off of the Mediterranean Sea, southeastern France or southern France. And the community hired Rav Yehuda al-Charizi to translate the Rambam. Rav Yehuda al-Charizi's translation is known to be not the most accurate in terms of a literal translation. He tried to capture the gestalt of the idea of the Rambam, and his translations might not be as literal, but they tried to capture the ethos of what the Rambam was saying. Now, let's go to more modern translations. So perhaps the earliest of the more modern translations was Rav Yosef Kapach, whose picture you can see on the far right. He was a Yemenite scholar that moved to Israel. He was one of the heads of the Yemenite community. He translated a number of Rambam's works from Arabic into Hebrew. One of the critiques of Rav Kapach's edition and translation of the Arabic into Hebrew is that Rav Kapach translated it into essentially modern Hebrew, which was not how scholars at the time studied Hebrew. So when you're studying the language and you're trying to infer things from the Rambam's particular words, it's not exactly the easiest or most user-friendly version to work with. So that was one of the critiques that they had of Rav Yosef Kapach's edition. Now, again, I don't mean to minimize it. It was an incredible work of scholarship and it's extremely accurate. But people felt that the translation wasn't, I guess, representative of how people may have studied and learned and spoke at the time in Hebrew. And it's certainly not traditional rabbinic Hebrew. So a couple decades later, Rav Yitzchak Shilat, who teaches at Ma'ale Adumim, Yeshivat Ma'ale Adumim, who's an expert in Rambam, he retranslated the Rambam's works using even more updated manuscripts that were found in Oxford, in Cambridge, in Moscow, different manuscripts of the Rambam's most finalized versions of the commentary to Mishnah. As I had mentioned, there were different editions, even in the Rambam's lifetime. So they collected all of them, and Rav Shilat retranslated it into what he believed is more traditional rabbinic Hebrew. So a lot of people like to use his. And then in the last few years, Rav Ezra Korach, who you can see in the last picture, Rav Shilat is in the middle. So Rav Ezra Korach, who's also a Yemenite rabbi in Israel, he's on the left, and he's actually speaking, delivering a lecture in memory of Rav Yosef Kapach. So even though he criticized Rav Kapach's edition, he's still speaking in his honor. So as you can see, the rabbis can have disagreements and still hold each other in the highest regard and esteem, something that we should keep in mind during these days of Sfiras HaOmer when we think about Rabbi Akiva's students. So Rav Ezra Korach, in the last, I think, I don't know, 2-3 years, retranslated it for a publishing company called Machon HaMa'ar, based on even newly discovered manuscripts, and he retranslated some of the words that he felt Rav Shilat did not get right. And I would say that that's the most updated version that we have. And again, it's not to minimize any of the previous editions. Rav Shilat is amazing. I used his work to prepare for these shiurim. Rav Kapach is great too. Rav Ezra Korach, though, is probably, I would say, the most modernized and most up-to-date scholarly edition. In terms of English, so oftentimes when we try to learn a rabbinic text, we try to keep it in Hebrew. But the Rambam himself didn't write it in Hebrew. And so it's really, in my opinion at least, and who am I, but in my opinion, it's a great thing to be able to study it in English as well. So I'll stop sharing the screen so you can see me. This is the work that I use. I'm going to hold it up so you can see. This is a Hebrew-English addition to the Rambam. It's called the Rambam's Guide to the Mishnah and Talmud. It was translated by Rabbi Tzvi Lampel. He's a rabbi in Israel. And he used the most up-to-date Hebrew translation from Rav Korach. And he wrote his own English translation. It's typeset very nicely. And in addition to that, he provides a rather extensive set of footnotes, which in addition to providing all the background sources, he also cross-references with other, writing projects that the Rambam undertook that either disagree or agree or corroborate what the Rambam wrote. And in addition to that, he also brings in other later commentaries, most notably Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, who was an early modern rabbi in Galicia in Europe in the, 1800s, early 1800s. It was at the very early stages of the, Reform movement. And he has these footnotes, which he uses to embellish what the Rambam was saying. I think it's a phenomenal addition. If anybody wants to get it, you can find it on Amazon. You can also find it. It's published by Judaica Press. If anybody wants me to either send them the information or facilitate them getting one, I'll be happy to do that. So that's the text that I worked off of when I prepared for these shiurim. I don't know what Safaria's Hebrew or English text is based on. So when I actually learn it with you, I'm going to be using that text, but if there are any differences or any significant differences, I'll tell you what the Rav Korach edition says. Another great resource to use, it's not only limited to the Rambam's introduction, but I highly recommend it if anybody's interested, Art Scroll, in honor of the Siyum HaShas last year, published an introduction to the Talmud, which has a history of the development of the Gemara, biographies of rabbinic sages. And at the end, they have a section where they translate not only the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, it's based off of Rav Shilat, but they incorporate some of the changes of, they incorporate some of the textual changes of Rav Korach. But in addition to the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, they also translate the Rambam's introduction to the Yad HaChazaka, the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's the Rambam's Hebrew Code of Jewish Law, which is a much more condensed version of the introduction. And so it's nice to sort of compare and contrast. And the Rambam wrote that in Hebrew. So that's a great resource to have. And in addition to that, they also translated Igeret Rav Sharira Gaon, who was one of the Gaonim who predated the Rambam by a few centuries, who actually wrote an overview of Torah Shebaal Peh and the history and development of the Talmud as well. I don't think the Rambam saw it. It was published in the Vilna Shas edition in the 1800s of the Gemara that we have now. I don't think the Rambam saw it because there are some differences. There are some minor differences in terms of the Rambam's historical version of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the evolution of the writing of the Talmud, of the writing of the Mishnah, which certainly academic scholars and many later rabbis as well say that the Rambam may not have been completely informed of the history of the development. Now, again, those differences are extremely small, and it should not dilute or mitigate in any way the significance of what the Rambam wrote. Again, 99% of it is almost universally accepted. There are a few things which other people disagree with, and I'll hope to raise those points when we get to them. Okay, so we're basically done. I just want to sum up by going back to the slideshow. I want to finish off with a letter that was translated to English. It was translated by Dr. Leon Stitzkin, who's a professor of Jewish philosophy. He translated a letter that the Rambam wrote to one of the translators of the commentary of the Mishnah, Ibn Tibbon, where the Rambam basically gives an account of his day. Now, the letter was written, he says, in September of 1199, which is towards the end of the Rambam's life. I would say the last 5 years or so of the Rambam's life. Rambam was in his 60s. He was not a young man, not a terribly old man, even at that time. But he had basically seen the majority of his life pass by him. And the Rambam gives us a synopsis or an overview of what a day in his life is like. I'll read from the top of page 94. Now God knows that in order to write this letter to you, I have escaped to a secluded spot where people would not think to find me, sometimes leaning for support against the wall, sometimes lying down on account of my excessive weakness, for I have grown old and feeble. The image of your mind is this person who has basically, with the exception of his second wife and young son, who was in his teens at the time, he is this old person who has seen most of the people that he loved die. And he's given so much to his community, but he's a scholar. He's an intellectual scholar. And if you read the Rambam's writings, and we'll go through some examples in the introduction to the Mishnah, the Rambam held in the greatest esteem the power of the intellect, the philosopher, somebody who meditates on God and strives for intellectual and spiritual internal perfection. And yet, the Rambam says that he is completely old and exhausted from being overworked. He continues, but with respect to your wish to come here to me, I cannot but say how greatly your visit would delight me. Yet I must advise you to not expose yourself to the perils of the voyage, for beyond seeing me and my doing all I could to honor, you would not derive any advantage for your visit in the help of the translating my works. Do not expect to be able to talk with me on any scientific subject for even an hour by day or by night, for the following is my daily occupation. He says that he lives in Fustat and the Sultan lives in Cairo, which is about a mile and a half journey, which by camel takes a while. And he spends most of his day in the Sultan's palace prescribing medications. He comes back in the afternoon. Then he says, then almost dying with hunger, I find the antechambers of my house filled with people, Jews, Gentiles, nobles, common men, judges, bailiffs, friends and foes who await my return. And he says he dismounts from his camel and he's going to his house. Everybody's waiting outside for him. He begs his patients to wait a few minutes so he can eat a little bit of a meal. It's the only meal that he eats in a 24-hour period. He sees his patients. He's right his prescriptions. Patients go in and out until nightfall and sometimes even until two or more hours into the night. He talks with them. He prescribes for them while lying down from sheer fatigue. And when night falls, I am so exhausted that I can scarcely speak. In consequence of this, no Jewish person can ever talk with me except on Shabbos. And on that day, the entire community, or at least most of them, come over to my house after Shacharis, after davening. I give them a shiur. We learn until noontime. Then they leave. And then people come back and they keep on talking to him and learning. And he gives them shiurim. He learns with them. And I have related to you only a part of what you would see if you were here to visit. And the image that you get is that here you have this person who is on the older side, who's just completely weighed down by communal responsibility. And what's interesting is that, once again, the Rambam valued intellect above everything else. And yet the Rambam did not do much scholarly work for most of his life. Instead, he was weighed down by communal responsibilities of treating patients, of mediating between different people, of teaching. The Rambam put what he believed was, in my opinion, the most enjoyable part of, at least if you read the Rambam, what he believed was the most enjoyable part of his life, he put that on the back burner, and he put on the back burner all of his literary projects, his commentary to Talmud, his book on prophecy. He put all of that on the back burner, and even his writing projects that he felt would benefit society, he would always put them on hold when a public service issue came to the forefront that he felt only he could tackle. And I'll close with this. It's very telling in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Mora Nevuchim. It starts off talking about very abstract, deep philosophical concepts. The very end, the last section, talks about chesed and kindness and helping another person. And the sense that you get is that according to the Rambam, all of the good and the value and utility of internal, spiritual, philosophical, ethical perfection that one gains from Torah study, from secular study, all of that, the entire end goal is to be able to help someone else and to serve the kahila. And to translate and to harness all of the innate abilities that a person has to help better the rest of Jewish society and the rest of broader society in general. And so we should keep that in mind when we learn the Rambam, when we learn the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, which we'll start, God willing, next week, that the Rambam's entire purpose to this book, to this commentary, and to this introduction is because he believed that everything contained in there was critical, not for the scholar, but for the entire Jewish community to understand and internalize as part of their Jewish identity and their Jewish lives. And once they did that, to then use that for themselves to help others as well. So I want to wish you a wonderful week. Hopefully this week will be a source of nechama, a source of comfort, and in preparation for Shavuos. Shavuos is in 2 weeks, God willing, where we will receive the Torah. And so we have to prepare for that, both in terms of redoubling our efforts to learn Torah, as well as to use that Torah to help other people and to use those values to help other people. I want to wish you all a wonderful, wonderful week.
Thank you very much.
Take care. At this time, if anybody has any questions or comments, you can feel free to unmute, or you can use the chat box.
Rabbi Svi, could you please show us the book that you're using as a source again?
Sure.
I'm using from Amazon, I put the title and show it for the world so you can see it on the screen.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
So it's the Rambam's Guide to Mishnah and Talmud. It's translated by Rabbi Tzvi Lempel. Tzvi is a ZVI. You can Google it. You can find it on Amazon, or you can go to JudaicaPress.com. If anybody needs any further help, you can reach out to me by email. I'll be happy to help you connect with him. All right. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you for your lesson. It was excellent. Thank you so much for everything.
Have a wonderful week. My pleasure.